Hello again, ladies and gentlemen. This is Brian McClanahan, and this is our last presentation in our constitutional history course. So, hope you enjoyed every presentation to this point and enjoyed the lectures by both myself and Dr. Gutzman. I'm sure he gave you a nice parting message in his last presentation, so I'll give you one here. And my goal, of course, in this entire process with my particular presentations was to ensure that you would understand how these pieces of legislation or court decisions or whatever we've talked about have linked to the founding father's view of the Constitution or the Constitution as ratified. And in this particular presentation, I'm going to do that as well. What I put on here is modern issues, and there's so many things we could talk about in the modern era. We've already addressed many of them in the presentations leading up to this, but some of the things that have happened, say, in the 1980s, 90s, and then, of course, in the 2000s, that are a direct affront to our individual liberty and the founding, the Constitution, I'd say, as ratified by the founders. So, the founding generation's view of the Constitution. So, you know, this is the overall theme of the course. You know, we looked at the Union, and the major purpose of the Constitution was to make a more perfect Union, the same kind of Union that they had under the Articles of Confederation. The issues that, of course, we've addressed in things like the General Welfare Clause and the Supremacy Clause and things of that nature, the Necessary and Proper Clause. And of course, those particular clauses are used today in a variety of ways to abridge our liberties and the federal union that the founders established in 1776 with the Articles, and then, of course, altered slightly in 1787, and then as ratified in the Constitution. So when we look at these modern issues, the major theme is basically going to be the expansion of the executive branch. I think if there's anything in the last, say, 100 years, that's been the dominant trend in terms of the destruction of the original Constitution. It has been just that, the power of the executive. And so we have the progressive era and people like Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, and of course, Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon. And you take your pick, and particularly in the last half century, all the presidents have abused executive power in one way or another. Even the exalted Ronald Reagan, who was responsible for creating this idea of a independent unitary executive, which we'll talk about in this particular presentation. I mean, he's not alone in that, but he actually codified it. So we have some major issues that still need to be addressed. And I'm not so certain about, and I'll talk about this in the summary presentation, you know, what to do from here. The only remedy, of course, would be to try to put the legislators' feet to the fire through education, and then you know, trying to decentralize or at least use the powers of the 10th Amendment and others to limit the power of the central authority. So let's just get into some of these modern issues. And as I mentioned before, the growth of the executive branch is the most dangerous development in the last 60 years, and it really is the major problem in American constitutional theory. When Franklin Roosevelt started using dictators during the New Deal era and then into the 1940s, that was the beginning of the end of any congressional control of the executive branch, because now you have these dictators who have powers that are essentially extra-constitutional. You assign a dictator to go in and handle some aspect of the economy. We're going to have a drug czar. So this drug czar is going to go out there and set regulation and do things and try to win the drug war, for example. I mean, this is just preposterous. And sometimes they'll ask Congress to have legislation that would correspond with that move, but you know, we have a green czar, so we can handle, you know, green jobs and all these stupid kind of things. So, I mean, this is the problem with the executive office. You know, we need a business czar or a car czar or a phone czar or whatever the heck. We have a Congress for that. You know, if Congress wants to have legislation dealing with these particular issues, of course, it would all be unconstitutional in that way. But let's just say, for the sake of purposes, the American people are 100% behind the federal government building windmills all over the United States and having solar power plants in every town in the United States. Well, then, if you want that type of stuff, then the Congress should pass legislation, and that would settle that. Instead of having some czar say, well, we need to have this regulation or that regulation. You know, when we get into federal regulatory agencies, in the end, one of the largest ones in this case is the EPA, which is just a disaster for the free market. I mentioned two others, but so I'll mention the EPA now. But you know, looking at the powers that they have over the American economy in terms of, you know, environmental regulations, it's preposterous. Now, nobody wants, you know, dirty air or dirty water and these kind of things. But the fact is that the states and localities could regulate these things, and not just that, you know, the free market would help establish this stuff. And one of the nicest examples, of course, of this, you have this conservation ethic theory that the governments conserve property while individuals ruin it. Is the Callaway Gardens Reserve in Pine Mountain, Georgia, where we just had the Mises 30th anniversary celebration. Callaway Gardens is privately owned. They control a large amount of territory, and they do a very nice job in conservation. So who's to say private individuals with that kind of motivation could not do it and preserve and protect property? I think particularly with education and people understand that, you know, one of the things about having property is maintaining it, ensuring it's a proper usage. Everybody wants to ensure that nobody's drinking polluted water or breathing nasty air or using property in an improper way. I think generally that comes down to education. And so it's not governments that actually protect this. It's still people that do it. So who's to say a private entity could not do it just as well? And of course, over this time, you know, the power of the purse and the sword, the president has both now. You know, the president actually writes a budget for the executive branch, which is the power of the purse. The president determines if we say this, you know, president's going to raise taxes, lower taxes. That actually doesn't happen, but we think the president does this. And of course, the president has almost uncontested control of the sword nowadays. Congress has just basically abdicated its authority in both regards. I mean, we don't have a budget. We haven't had a budget now in 2012 for 3 years. And that's because Congress has basically said, well, we'll just pass you continuing resolutions funding different programs. We're waiting on some type of presidential direction here. Well, my gosh, write a budget and get it passed. This is preposterous to put it all from the executive, which I think happens at times. And then when it comes to foreign policy and decisions of war and peace, the Congress really has all the control there according to the Constitution as ratified, but they put it off on the president again. So when the president has taken this power, and in some ways the presidents have usurped it from Congress and not given it back, and the Congress hasn't been bold enough to stand up to the president. And I put on here the American king and the antithesis of the founder's design. I mean, what we have today is an American king, supported the way the monarchs of old were supported perpetually. The amount of money that's spent on the American presidency just trumps the amount of money spent in other developed countries on their executives. For example, we spend over $1 billion a year on the president, whereas if you just look at the British monarchy, they don't spend nearly, not even half that much or even close to that much. So on the Queen of England. And I think this is a preposterous development. And I think if the founders had thought that this would happen, they never would have ratified the document to begin with. Even the most ardent proponents of the Constitution would have looked at the American presidency today with disdain, because the president has more power than George III ever had. And they rebelled and, or I should say, seceded from the British Empire because of that. So we're in a major mess now, and a lot of that has to do with the executive branch. So let's look at some of the issues here, just a cursory analysis of some of the things going on. But one of the things presidents have tried to do, of course, is have a presidential enemies list. You know, Richard Nixon was famous for this. Barack Obama has a kill list. And the way they could do this in terms of domestic terrorism, quote-unquote domestic terrorism, was through wiretaps, how they could control that. Well, the Supreme Court came down in 1972 and said you can't do it. Again, you know, the wiretaps had always been illegal through the Fourth Amendment. And now in 1972, the Supreme Court says you can't do it again. Domestic wiretaps are still illegal without a warrant. They violate the Fourth Amendment. In fact, when the decision was made, one of the judges in the decision process said the price of lawful public dissent must not be a dread of subjection to an unchecked surveillance power, nor must the fear of unauthorized official eavesdropping deter vigorous citizen dissent, discussion of government action, and private conversation. For private dissent, no less than open public discourse is essential to our free society. So here is the Supreme Court in 1972 saying, you know what, dissent is the essence of America. We've long had it, and if you're able to trample it and stifle it, then we're in real trouble. And so this brings an interesting issue. What about the Patriot Act? After September 11, 2001, the Congress was able to ram through the Patriot Act very quickly, and there's some discussion about this thing actually being written way beforehand, and they had it on the books. And so now that this attack happens, they're able just to push this thing through, and nobody really knows what's in it yet. It's written and passed in a very short period of time. And of course, this thing allows for domestic surveillance in a way that is very scary. I mean, the Congress, the Homeland Security Department, the CIA, the FBI have tremendous leeway in eavesdropping on Americans, whether it's through the internet, whether it's through telecommunications. This is a real problem because what's happened, unless you're very good at if you don't want the government to know it's completely off the grid, it's almost impossible for there to be any type of private dissent or public dissent in any way, because the government could clamp down on it very quickly. Now, they don't. I think some of this is on purpose, but the potential is always there for it. So this is why we have to be on guard for this kind of thing. You know, to have a president with a kill list is a very dangerous thing. For the president to be able to, for that matter, to be able to kill American citizens without due process is also a very dangerous thing. And that's essentially what's happened. We all know that some of these radicals who are threatening harm to U.S. Civilians and infrastructure is not a good thing. But these people should also have due process if they are American citizens. They should be tried in a court of law and found guilty, and then, of course, you have recourse. But just to simply say, well, they're terrorists and we're going to kill them, I mean, who's to say, how do you classify a terrorist? How do you classify dissent as being detrimental to the public safety? Would this type of material be eventually considered detrimental to the public safety if we're saying that the government, the emperor has no clothes and the government is abusing its power? That's a serious question. Of course, you know, through the internet and through telecommunications, the government knows exactly what we're saying at all times. I mean, I'm sure they can pretty much monitor anything they want. You know, they can read your emails, look at your Facebook pages, do all the things that we think are private, really they aren't. The Imperial Presidency continues with the War Powers Resolution of 1973. This is an interesting piece of legislation because it required Congress to be notified within 48 hours of the use of the American military by the executive branch. And it also prohibited the use of the military for more than 60 days without congressional authorization or a declaration of war. And they also give you a 30-day wind-down period. So about 90 days is what you have. As president, you can send the army into an area unilaterally. And then you have 90 days to clean up your mess before the Congress has to authorize it again or declare war. So what this does essentially gives the president a 90-day window to use the military in any way they want to. They just have to notify Congress. Now, there are two interesting questions here. First, some people would say that, well, the presidents have said this is unconstitutional because I want to be able to use the military however I want to repel sudden attacks. I shouldn't have to notify Congress of that. It's blatantly unconstitutional because it's violating my role as commander-in-chief to use the Army and Navy as I see fit. Well, that's preposterous. And so I put on here constitutional. That's one way people have said it's unconstitutional. But I think what Congress did here was just a terrible move, because what they have done is, again, abdicated what the founders thought was the power of the sword. They thought Congress had this power, not the president. So if the United States was attacked, and we'll use, examples in the founding period. So, for example, the United States commercial fleet was being attacked by the Barbary pirates. So Jefferson would send in the Navy to help address that, to protect American commerce. That is not a violation of the powers of Congress, because, of course, he did have authorization to do it. And not just that, this is to defend American interests. We're not actually going out and attacking anybody. Now, there was, of course, the attack, with Stephen Decatur to try to save Americans who had been captured by the Barbary pirates. But regardless of that, the fact is America's, at that time, even under the Adams administration with the quasi-war with France, we're protecting our shipping, we're protecting our interests. So, and the Congress had authorized these things. But when you look at what happened with the Reagan years, the Clinton years, and the Obama years, the most recent example, of course, is in Libya, where Obama doesn't even ask the Congress for authorization, doesn't even notify them, just uses the military to help out in Libya. I mean, that's a violation of the War Powers Resolution. Of course, Clinton doing that in Bosnia. And this is a real problem. But the issue at hand should be, should the president even have this authority to do this in the first place? That's where this law is really unconstitutional and a violation of the founder's constitution, the constitution as ratified. And I talk about this in my book, The Founding Fathers' Guide to the Constitution. I bring this exact issue up. The War Powers Resolution was an affront to the way the founding generation looked at war powers in general. Congress had the power of the sword, not the president. And Congress had to have the final say in whether the military should be used or not. And that was to protect it, to protect the American people from an abusive executive branch, a king who would just send the army in at his will. So, I mean, now for 90 days, the president can do whatever he wants. He can send the military wherever he wants. And so you have 60 days of combat and then 30 days of wind down. Well, you can say we're winding down with modern logistics. You can get troops out of an area very quickly. So the president basically has 90 days to do whatever he wants with the American military. Well, I think that's very, very dangerous. And the founders would have looked at it and said, you can't do that. You can't have 3 months. You know, wars can be over in 3 months. Look at the Spanish-American War. It was over in 3 months. So, I mean, you know, you got 3 months. You know, you can notify us and go attack a country and end the war in 3 months. This is how ridiculous this thing is. So the imperial presidency gets even bigger, actually, with the War Powers Resolution. You know, the question was, of course, Vietnam at this point and not having a declared war. But we haven't had a declared war since 1941. So, you know, we've had our troops involved in all kinds of conflicts, and the Congress usually will just authorize it anyway. So where's the real check? So this is a dangerous precedent to have. And then, of course, we have the issue of the unitary executive. This is the theory that the president has broad and uncontested control over the executive branch. And it was made more popular since the 1980s, but particularly during the George W. Bush administration. The question is this constitutional? So how did the founders consider the executive? Well, this question of a single or plural executive and how much control the executive would have over the actual executive branch. There was a tremendous amount of control over the executive branch. I think that that's not really contested here. You know, George Washington had a lot of control over the executive branch. You know, they have control to select appointments. But the real question here is how much control the Congress will have over the executive branch. And that's where the Senate comes into play. So I put on here constitutional. I'll talk about these signing statements in a second. But, you know, is this constitutionally? The Senate is supposed to have the advice and consent of the president on a variety of issues, whether it's foreign policy with treaties, and we'll talk about that in the next slide, or whether it's appointment powers. You know, the Congress can control how different executive branches are different parts of the executive branch are set up. But the president did have appointment powers, and so because of that, the president could appoint who he wanted as long as Congress approved of it. So you get into the issue, how much control does the Congress actually have over the executive branch? And since the Reagan administration made this unitary executive, he codified it in a executive order, since then you've had a tremendous expansion of this unitary power of the president, almost acting like a king, again, at will, without any congressional oversight. Now, the signing statements were made very popular in the George W. Bush administration. And basically what would happen is the Congress would pass a law and the president would execute that law, but they would put something in the execution of that law called a signing statement, which essentially what Bush was doing was saying, well, this part of the law is invalid, so I'm not going to execute that part of the law. So the job of the president is to execute the laws of Congress. If they don't like the law, then they should just veto it. If they think the law is unconstitutional, then you have to veto it. Now, the question here is, you know, should we have a line item veto, which Congress actually gave the president at one point, and then that was declared unconstitutional? Should the president be able to say in a single symbol statement on executing a law, well, I don't think this part is constitutional, so I'm not going to execute this part. You either have to veto the law or not. So again, here is the president acting very much like a king, and saying, I'm going to do this or do that. And of course, if your man's in office, then you're fine with that. You know, Republicans felt very comfortable with George W. Bush in that way. But with Barack Obama in office, Republicans didn't, and vice versa. Democrats were critical of Bush for doing this. Now with Obama in office, they just want the Republicans to get out of the way and let Obama do whatever he wants. So this is the real problem with our system, the way it's structured, that the president even believes they can have this kind of power, a signing statement. I mean, it just is a gross violation of the Constitution as ratified. Then, of course, we have treaties. According to the Constitution, the president has to have the advice and consent of the Senate in terms of treaties. But what we've gotten are executive agreements, which are as different, which are similar, I should say, to executive orders. An executive order is an order from the executive branch, the president, implementing a law. They make an order to make a change to something or to implement a law. Well, an executive agreement is similar, but it's an agreement with a foreign power, and it holds the weight of a treaty. It's a unilateral control of foreign policy. And so the founders' position was much different than this. Now, Jefferson and Madison actually believed in something called congressional executive agreements, where the Congress actually had a role in commerce. And in fact, this was defended. The Constitution, this part of the Constitution was defended by even opponents of the Constitution, saying, well, you know, Congress has to have some role in commerce, for example. And again, I talk about this particular issue in my Founding Fathers' Guide to the Constitution. But the real problem is, should the president have just unilateral control of of foreign policy in this way, the Senate does have to have advice and consent. And even when George Washington had Jay's Treaty, which was one of the most unpopular treaties in American history, cross his desk, he still went to the Senate and wanted it ratified anyways, because that was the proper procedures that had to be followed in the Constitution. So the fear of an executive agreement would simply be something like, the United Nations passes a resolution saying, arms reduction or whatever the case may be, and the president signs an executive agreement with all the countries to do this without Senate confirmation or without Senate to, you know, ratification, I should say, of that particular treaty. So that's the real issue here. Can the president act unilaterally in this way? And the real scary thing is that since 1939, 95% of all foreign agreements have been so-called executive agreements. And things like the World Bank, our participation in that, the IMF, GATT and NAFTA were all part of these executive agreements. And these things are very unpopular in certain aspects. I mean, even if you like free trade, you know, NAFTA can cause problems. The General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, all these things are executive agreements, and the Congress has not been consulted. The Senate has not been consulted. So that creates an issue. I mean, did the president actually violate the Constitution by doing this? I think if you look at the Constitution as ratified, absolutely. The Senate would have to have the final say in any kind of treaty that's made, whether it's a UN resolution, you know, you look at the Kyoto Accords, you know, if we're going to join that thing and have all these carbon caps and all that stuff. I mean, all these things should be ratified through the Senate and the proper procedures, but the presidents don't really care to do it because it's just easier to go outside and do an end around Congress and get around the issue that way. So I put on the bottom here the War on Terror, the NDAA, and the Patriot Act. The War on Terror and these particular type of things when it comes to treaties, you know, if you look at some of the things that are going on with that, like the NDAA and the suspension of habeas corpus, this essentially is, again, unilateral control of foreign policy, because the president says we have a war on terror, which is a foreign problem. Now we can have domestic surveillance with the Patriot Act. Now we can suspend habeas corpus. So we're extending those war powers out beyond the supposed a foreign policy problem, which is the war on terror. So this is why it's very important to ensure that the Senate has some type of control over the president in these particular issues. And again, the 17th Amendment destroyed any kind of state control over the Senate. So now the president has easy access to the senators, and because of the popularity vote, senators usually are not ousted. It's very, you know, incumbents generally win. So now you have a real problem in that regard. But, you know, the war on terror being a foreign policy issue, of course, is going to affect domestic policy. And with the NDAA of 2011, you know, the president can just go in and arrest people, you know, habeas corpus and everything else, or 2012, I should say, and throw them in jail indefinitely. So here's a foreign policy issue causing domestic problems. Now, Congress is not out of the woods and not without blame in this particular issue, and I put on here earmarks and congressional spending power. In the founding period, earmarks are what people like Jefferson wanted. In fact, this is what Ron Paul had said. Well, look, everything should be an earmark. Everything should be an earmark, because when you earmark something, you're actually saying that this money is going to be spent for this specific purpose. We're not going to have block grants of money or large chunks of money go into a federal department, and then we'll worry about the executive branch determining how this money is going to be spent. We're going to say this money is spent here, and this money is spent here, and this money is spent here. And that will allow the American people to go through the budget line by line and say, okay, well, this is what we should cut out of the budget. So earmarks are very important, and I wish everything in the budget was an earmark. That way we could really see what the Congress is doing to abuse its power. And, of course, congressional spending power is just off the rails. I mean, they can do whatever they want now. They completely disregard Article 1, Section 8. So let me explain a couple of areas here just very briefly when you look at some of these issues. So I have roads, regulations, and regular checkups, you know, commerce and defense. The interstate system, which of course we got in the Dwight Eisenhower administration. For years, in the founding period, it was said, you know, Madison and Monroe, for example, vetoed internal improvements bills when people were trying to get federal spending on roads. And even in the Philadelphia Convention, the Pennsylvania delegation brought up the issue of canals and roads and things like that. We should be able to spend federal money on that. And they believed you could do that under the General Welfare Clause of Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1. But that was rebuffed. They said no. I mean, this was actually rejected at that time. Benjamin Franklin tried to get a piece, you know, saying we can dig canals and we can expand that out to other things. But George Mason knocked this down in the Philadelphia Convention. So this idea of federal spending on roads has long, or at least in the founding period, was long opposed. And when we move forward, there's never been a constitutional amendment to do it. But when we get to the 1950s and Dwight Eisenhower thinks, well, you know, I was in Europe and they got in Germany, they have this wonderful thing called the Autobahn. We should have that here and we should do it here because of defense. So what the Congress has started doing is saying, well, we can do anything we want as long as it's in the name of defense spending. So the interstate system was put into effect because it's defense spending. We got to be able to ship, you know, have men and material move down these interstates because it's faster, you know, from New York to Florida or something like that, or, you know, from New York to California or whatever it is, you know, somewhere in the middle. We got to have these interstates to do it. But what's happened as well is that now the interstates are defended under the Commerce Clause because this is now interstate commerce, and we have to have roads to facilitate commerce. So railroads, you know, for a long time it was railroads, now it's roads, and the federal government was building railroads in the 19th century through subsidies. They shouldn't be able to do that. So this is just broadened out to this monster that we have today, whereas now if somebody wants a road built, and I'll give you an example in the area where I live, there's a couple of areas that need some road development. The county has act and the city has actually gone to the federal government and says, we want to build these roads. We're not going to build it until you give us the money to do it. Well, my gosh, what did the people of Maine have to do with a road in Columbus, Georgia, or Alabama? I mean, it's completely ridiculous to think that the people of another state should have to build a road in the state of Georgia or the state of Alabama. It just doesn't make any sense, but that's what we're doing. That's all under commerce and defense. You get the expansive commercial regulations and federal regulatory agencies. So I give you two examples here, the FCC and OSHA. The FCC, of course, the Federal Communications Commission, was created in the 1930s, and the idea was to regulate the airwaves. So what's happened is now you have basically a government monopoly on who can and cannot have a radio station, who can and cannot have television station, what you can put on the TV and what you can't put on the TV. And the FCC makes these rules. These regulatory agencies are judge, jury, and executioner. They're all three branches at one. You had the Interstate Commerce Commission, which was the first in the late 19th century. But essentially what they do is they pass the regulations. They then enforce the regulations. And they decide if you're guilty of the regulations themselves. So they can fine you for this. And they can say yes or no if you want to have a radio station. You can't just put up a tower in your backyard and try. Now, everyone thinks, well, you know, we should have some type of control over that. And this was actually sold on defense, because, you know, they want some subversive group having a radio station, and putting out their information over the airwaves. I mean, okay, does the government have this kind of power? And, you know, so if it's defense or if it's commerce, I mean, they're saying it's interstate and those things because, of course, these radio waves can go across interstate go across state lines. But perhaps this is more of a state issue than a federal issue. You know, who's to say that the state governments couldn't say, well, you can and cannot have these radio stations, or, you know, who's to say the people of a state should be able to decide? And they can at times decide what kind of material that they should be allowed to have in their particular state. You know, states can regulate what kind of material, obscene material is shown, for example, on television. But we know that this stuff has been relaxed over the years and more can be shown on television, for example, than before. But again, is this the federal charge to do this, and where in the Constitution does it say they can? And then OSHA, you know, you have to wear your hard hat. You got to have this law and this labor law and that labor law and this regulation in your workplace, which has created all kinds of problems for businesses to actually do business because they have to follow these OSHA regulations. We all want to be safe at work, but again, what does the federal government have the power to regulate what people are doing in their private employment? You know, if you have your hard hat or not. So again, here are some things that you know, the government has definitely overstepped its bounds, and it's all done under commerce and defense. And finally, Obamacare, you know, originally was sold as part of the Commerce Clause, and then it was found to be a tax, but this is a massive regulation of the economy, and it violates, you know, the free market. So does, you know, so most regulatory agencies do. So, Obamacare is going to be a jobs killer because people have to comply with all these new regulations. As we've seen now, a lot of these regulations were held back until after the election, and now companies are laying off jobs en masse because they have to pay for all these massive regulations that they're going to get. And so they're going to start firing workers. And, you know, that's the major problem with regulation. So Congress has been culpable in this. They pass this legislation. And then, of course, these regulations are put into effect, which often the regulations are under the executive branch. So it's just this two-headed monster that's going after the free market at all times in the United States. All right. Well, in summary, basically, if you look at the Constitution today, and the government we have today, it's an unrecognizable central government to the founding generation. They'd be spinning in their grave. In fact, there's very few people in the last half century that have been strong proponents of bringing back the original union of the founders, the Federal Republic. I mean, one is Ron Paul. Another is an individual I wrote about in my Forgotten Conservatives, Sam Ervin of North Carolina, who was a rock star in the 1970s because he was trying to take down Richard Nixon. You know, people think he's inconsistent because before that he was against a federal legislation on civil rights, but so was Barry Goldwater, and for proper reasons, because this was out of the purview of the federal government. But you know, Sam Ervin of North Carolina, you know, he never said one that I read a segregationist statement in his life outside of, or at least racist statement outside. He said, well, this should be a state issue. You know, so as he goes after Richard Nixon, you know, his autobiography was entitled Preserving the Constitution. He's talking about the Constitution of the Founders. And he's a great person to study when you're looking at, you know, preserving civil liberties and this federal union, this federal republic. Again, Ron Paul, the same thing. What you're getting, you know, a broad executive and legislative powers unheard of in the 1780s in the last, 50 or 60 years. The question is the Constitution outdated? This is something that was asked to me. Well, you know, why should we pay attention to what the Founding Fathers think about the Constitution? I mean, we have issues now like radio communication, internet, and all these things, and issues that the Founders never had to deal with. Well, I don't think that's true. You know, communication in 1780 was the same thing as communication today. They had to make sure that there was a free press at that time. They had to make sure that they could actually circulate letters freely and communicate ideas freely and be able to speak their mind freely. It doesn't matter the medium of being able to do that, whether it's over the airwaves or through the internet or through writing a letter to somebody. It's the same thing. It's all communication, private or public. So this is why it doesn't matter what you're talking about, what kind of technology you're looking at, communication is still communication. Civil liberties are still civil liberties. Whether it's searching your car, you know, as you're stopped at a police checkpoint, or in 2012, or the British redcoats busting into your house in 1776 because they think that you're helping out the patriot cause, it's the same thing. It's still proper search and seizures. Seizing papers has to be done properly. The 10th Amendment has not changed, and state authority has not changed. The Union has not changed. We still live under the same federal union that was established in 1776 under the Articles of Confederation. It is the same union, and that's the union that we should be following. So liberty is the same in 1788 or 2012. But I put on here the Constitution as ratified is dead. And of course, in Tom Woods and Kevin Gutzman's book, Who Killed the Constitution, that's the first thing that, you know, they said in the conclusion, the Constitution is dead. Well, I would say the Constitution as ratified is dead. You still have this unwritten Constitution that's very much living and around us all the time, where the government can do whatever it wants. That Constitution as ratified, which was a limitation on federal powers, is dead. So in that way, 100% correct and agree with that. Okay, well, again, I hope you enjoyed the course, and I hope you enjoyed the lectures, and take a look at the reading list that we have for you and the PowerPoint presentations, and take some time to click on the links that we provided. I hope that this course is as stimulating for you as it was for me to help come up with it and present it to you. And I hope it makes you a better constitutional scholar. Again, in my conclusion to my Founding Fathers' Guide to the Constitution, I said one of the only things that we have is education. So that's why this particular course in Liberty Classroom is so important, because the only thing we have is education defeating this Leviathan in Washington, D.C. That's it. If we don't have education, if we don't spread this around exponentially, if we don't get people involved, if you have friends, get them involved in Liberty Classroom. Buy them a subscription yourself. Give it to them as a gift and say, look at this class on the Constitution, because this is what you should be thinking about when you vote. Don't think about all these other issues. Think about the Constitution when you vote. Can the Congress do this? Can the President do that? Can the Supreme Court do this? And vote for candidates who follow the Constitution. I think that's the best thing we could do for the future. And then also look at your state and local governments, because that's really where all the power is. And we looked at that from the colonial period forward. The founding generation believed that local authority was supreme and paramount and important for civil liberties and the rights of the individual. So keep the pressure on, put their feet to the fire, and do some good work, and really understand, digest, and embrace this Constitution as ratified, and of course the constitutional principles of the United States. All right, until then, I'll see you next time.